and welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet Radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. So on my life's journey, I majored in economics in college, and part of that large educational experience that I actually remember is the distinction between something called total utility and marginal utility. Utility measures your satisfaction or the value that something has to you. So if I were to ask you, what has more value to you, water or diamonds? You might think, well, diamonds, of course, they're so valuable and I'd love to get a handful of those and I'd be rich for life, etc., etc. Because each unit is so expensive versus water. Whereas water, I can turn on the tap, it's free, I'll take the diamonds. That's an example of marginal utility. That is the value of one unit of an item, a commodity or a good or a service, etc. Total utility, on the other hand, is something very different. It's the total satisfaction that you get from all of your use of that product. So, if I were to tell you that you had a choice to do away with either diamonds or water in your life, which would you choose? Well, obviously, you could not do away with water. We use it to drink, to grow our food, to bathe, to clean, and so on and so forth. But diamonds, well, they're very valuable, but my life is fine without diamonds, and so would yours be. So while each glass of water is cheap, water overall is a critically more valuable commodity that we can't live without. But because many of us feel pretty certain that we're always going to be able to get clean water from our tap, and that it's pretty affordable, we're perhaps in a place where we're taking it a bit for granted. And this is happening at a time when our climate is changing, with unprecedented long droughts that you're seeing on the news, reduced snowpacks in our mountains, water supplies being threatened, rivers and reservoirs getting dangerously low, things that we thought would last forever now shrinking to the point where they can no longer meet our demands. Our water infrastructure is also aging and in need of replacing, and some of our city's water pipes go back to the 1800s. This and more has created the need for us to collectively take immediate action to protect our water. So to inspire you to take that on, we're going to spend the next 50 minutes or so giving you a close-up look, not just at the surprising ways that we're using water in this country, but at the challenges that we face in a world with an unstable climate. We'll also discuss some of the exciting solutions that exist that are already to be implemented today. And we're very happy to have with us this evening, to enlighten you on this important topic, someone whose work around education and action is, you guessed it, on water. Her name is Mary Grant, and she's the Public Water for All campaign director at a very important organization that I have a great deal of respect for, Food and Water Watch. Welcome to The Healthy Planet, Mary.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Mary, you're not the first guest that we've had on this show from Food and Water Watch. I think we've had a few, but I will ask you to start by giving our audience an idea of the kind of work Food and Water Watch does in the world, as well as the role that you play there.
Oh, sure. So Food and Water Watch is a nonprofit environmental organization. We champion big, bold solutions to the most pressing food, water, and climate problems of our time. Our theory of change is really in mobilizing regular people to take action, to hold their elected officials accountable, to pass bold legislation and policy solutions so that we can tackle these problems head on and really create the solutions that we need. My role, I'm really lucky. I get to work with our fabulous organizers and digital team on all of our water campaigns. So I work with our organizers, our team on our water campaigns to support local control of water, affordable water service, and safe water for all. We work at the local level, the state level, and the federal level, working to pass bold legislation to make sure that everyone has access to safe, affordable, and publicly controlled water.
Well, I thank you in advance for all of the work that you do and have been doing. And your work is extremely important right now and needed. And our audience is here to be inspired, and you will get a chance to explain why it's so needed, everything that you do. So let's start out by talking about the big picture of the state of our water supply in the United States. Water issues, as I mentioned, from droughts to water shortages, from falling reservoir levels and disappearing rivers even, are making it into the daily news, which is good to see. It's horrible, but it's good to see that it's getting public attention. And with the drying up of the Colorado River and reservoirs like Lake Mead and water crises in various parts of the country, we're seeing that the powers that be are scrambling to find a solution. And they're trying to say, how can we continue giving people water, generating electricity from our hydroelectric, having water for agriculture so we can feed people? And how do we do this in a world where these resources that we thought were forever are dwindling and changing? So, Mary, I'm going to ask you to give our audience a real sense of the challenges that we're facing today by painting a pretty detailed picture of the state of our water resources around the United States and some of what's happening with our resources, rivers, et cetera.
The United States is facing a water crisis, and what that water crisis looks like really varies based on where you live. Water is such a local issue. So across the country, various communities are facing different crises in terms of water access. And the story of our water crises is the story of climate change. The climate crisis, for many people, the first impact of the climate crisis will be felt through their water supply and their access to water. It could be the flooding in streets in Detroit. It could be wells going dry in California. We're seeing the impacts of climate change right now, and we're seeing them most very profoundly in terms of our access to safe water. Right now, my thoughts are with Jackson, Mississippi, which on Monday declared a state of emergency because they lost water. They've had torrential rain and downpour, or climate change driven storms affecting having historic rains in Jackson, Mississippi, took a pump offline. Treatment plant failed. They're not able to have water pressure. They've been under a boil water order for more than a month. They've had years of water problems, but this climate catastrophe once again hit Jackson, Mississippi, took their water system offline. And people are struggling right now. There's a big, massive water distribution effort in Jackson right now, but a lot of work needs to be done to make water systems climate resilient. Climate resiliency, again, it really depends on where you are in the country about what that looks like. But it is clear that across the country, people are struggling to provide safe water at levels that people need. In California, several wells have gone completely dry because of the historic mega drought that they're experiencing. Streets are flooding in other parts of the country. And for some systems, the wastewater systems are getting overloaded with stormwater, causing sewage to overflow into our rivers, polluting our rivers, and also at the same time, causing sewage to back up into homes. In cities like Baltimore, sewage backups, people are having their basements flooded with raw sewage. It's not only a crisis for that homeowner, it's a public health issue, a human health issue when we don't have reliable services. Our board chair is Maude Barlow, a wonderful water advocate and activist. And she often talks about the interplay between our water crises and the climate crisis. So on one hand, we need to address the climate crisis in order to address all of these water crises. And then on the other hand, we need to handle how we abuse water in order to help address the climate crisis. Because there's also, even without the climate crisis, we have water abuse in this country. We have big factory farms overusing water supplies, growing almonds in a desert. And we have big industries like the oil and gas industry using water supplies in drought-stricken areas. We're abusing our water, polluting it. We have big industrial pollution. There's PFAS forever chemicals. These are lab-made chemicals that is now found in the rainwater around the world. We are abusing our water supply. So even without the climate crisis, we are abusing our water supply, and we need to stop that and address that. And our board chair, Maude Barlow, makes this really fascinating point that if we address how we abuse our water supply, if we stop some of these water abuses, can actually help address the climate crisis. So I think these are two very interrelated crises, the water crisis, the climate crisis. and that we have bold solutions at our hands to try to stop both of them. And they really need to go hand in hand. We need to have this massive federal investment in our water infrastructure. We view the bipartisan infrastructure law that passed last year as a down payment on what is needed. We really need to have a comprehensive solution to really meet the need with the urgency that it demands. And we need to stop fossil fuel extraction. We need to ban fracking. We need to really address the fossil fuel polluters too, so that we can stop our climate crisis.
Yeah, there's so much to say about water. And living on Long Island, which is the general area that this is broadcast, we don't see the rivers. We don't see the reservoirs. We don't know what's happening to the aquifers out west and in the Midwest. Talk a little bit about what's happening with those.
Historic lows. Lake Mead, Lake Powell, they're reaching historic lows. These are the two biggest reservoirs in the country. The water levels just keep falling. This is going to impact not only water use for people, water use for the food that we need yeah. and along the Colorado River, but it also is going to impact power generation. A lot of the West relies on hydropower. So it has profound impacts on everyday life for people when the water levels keep falling. There is a historic mega drought in the western part of the United States. And the Colorado River is the most endangered river in the country. It has been endangered for a while, but what we're seeing right now is unprecedented. There's unprecedented cuts into the water usage. In January of next year, states like Arizona are going to have to make substantial cuts in their water usage from these reservoirs. And that's going to be really telling about how we go about managing water in a more equitable way. We need to make sure that as we cut back on water usage, that we're not hurting people. We need to make sure we're going after these water abuses. One of the things we've been calling for in California for a while is that we should first before we tell people not to flush their toilets or wash their hands, that we need to make sure that we have water so people can have essential usage before these wells go dry, that for water for people to drink. We need to make sure that we're stopping these corporate abusers. We need to stop factory farms, abuse of water. We need to really shift what we're growing out west in the desert to more drought-resistant crops. I mean, there are solutions out there that are good for farmers and they're good for people. And the issue is about the water rights system in the western part of the United States is highly flawed. Farmers are very scared that if they switch to drought-resistant crops, they'll actually lose their water allocation because of how the water rights system is managed. So there's a lot of huge issues. The water rights system too along the Colorado River has historically been, always been over allocated. So too many people have claims to use that water and now it's really hitting home. And so as we go into this crisis, as we think about how we use our water, we need to first stop these abuses of water. We need to stop oil and gas drilling of these abuses of water and these factory farms that are growing water wasteful crops. And we need to help small farmers in particular transition to crops that they can actually grow so they don't have to fallow their fields. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but it's possible, right? We just need to build the political will to get it done.
It is possible. If we outline the problem and the challenges correctly, the solutions are possible. If we don't do that, however, we're not going to get where we need to go. And I'll bring up something that agriculture is obviously a primary user of water in the United States, as you've mentioned. And one issue that we've discussed repeatedly on this show is the heavy burden that specifically animal agriculture places on our water supplies. Because obviously, if you're raising all this food to feed to an animal, and then you're feeding that animal over the course of its lifetime, that's going to take a lot more water than it would to just eat the food as it grows from the ground. But interestingly, if you look at a pie chart of the water use in California that was put out in 2012 by the Pacific Institute when they were studying where California is using all of its water, you'll see that a bit less than half of all their water use is attributable to the dairy industry. They grow a lot of alfalfa since it takes a lot of water to grow all that alfalfa. And also you have to give all those dairy cows water and also process them and clean the facilities, et cetera, it requires a lot of water. But if you look at that pie chart, it'll also show that agriculture overall uses the vast majority of all water in California. And yet, In a plan put forth by California's governor, agriculture and fossil fuels are not addressed. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that?
It's a missed opportunity, and in many ways, it's pretty shameful that the governor didn't target the water abusers. They didn't call for stopping these wasteful water practices. And instead, what we're seeing is fast-tracking some of these kind of damaging water supply projects, calling for more responsible water usage and responsible water management, calling for these technology solutions like desalination or a big tunnel project that can actually damage ecosystems. And ocean desalination in particular can actually exacerbate our climate crisis. It is so incredibly energy intensive. And then there's a lot of damage to the marine ecosystem around
it. Right. Where does all that salt go?
Mm-hmm. They just dump it back into the ocean. This is not a good solution. There's actually been a lot of grassroots activism in California that has successfully stopped desalination plants. So while the governor is trying to green light and fast track desalination plants, people are showing up in like droves to try to stop these plants from damaging their communities. Huntington Beach desalination, after 22 years, earlier this year, the Coalition Against the Poseidon Desalination Plant won a huge victory. They finally stopped the desalination plant. This was 2 decades long battle to try to stop this wasteful boondoggle of a project, and they won. And it's because of that community-driven activism, even though the governor still supported that Poseidon plant too. And he's supporting kind of removing some regulations to try to fast-track desalination is what it looks like based on the plan that was released earlier this summer. And that's alarming too, because if you're going to do a water supply project, regardless of what it is, you want to make sure that it's environmentally sound. So we don't need to remove protections for our environments as well as like protecting indigenous cultures. There's a lot of protections that are, California actually has a really strong environmental protection law, and that it really is expansive, and it's not a good idea to try to circumvent that because it's so good. So it's alarming that his solution is to circumvent environmental protections instead of actually tackling those big wasteful water abusers. I think it's demonstrating a lack of political will.
Yeah, it's really something. It's surprising. So most people associate fossil fuels with climate change and air pollution, rightfully so. But as you've mentioned, fossil fuels are also a major user and polluter of water in this country. I want you to just give that a little color. Explain some of the impacts of fossil fuels on water, including the incredibly water-intensive process of hydrofracking, oil and the pollution and the use and nuclear power. Talk about some of those.
Yeah, oil and gas production is a huge water user. For nuclear power in particular, a lot of water is used to cool the reactors. But for fracking, you just pump tons of water down in. And using the process, it pumps a lot of water in. It goes down, you inject fracking fluids. These are chemicals we don't even know what they are. They're refusing to disclose what's in it. But these are toxic chemicals. They inject into the ground, could contaminate the aquifer, the surrounding groundwater. And then they get all of this produced water back up. There's actually a whole industry around. One of the interesting things we've seen in Pennsylvania is that a lot of these private water corporations were part of a coalition called the Marcellus Shale Coalition, advocating for for more fracking in Pennsylvania and in the state. And it was interesting because why would a private water company support fracking when it can contaminate water supplies? Because there's a big industry, a lot of profit to be made by selling water to frackers. It uses so much water that. And it also produces so much wastewater that the water corporations see a market. They see opportunity for profit and delivering water and then treating wastewater. That's the first thing that comes to mind when I think about like how much water is used. These water corporations were so inspired by how much water it uses that they joined a coalition to advocate for more fracking.
That's something. That is something. And we're talking about a well could use millions of gallons. Mm. And then consider that there are over 900,000 fracking wells in the United States alone. And they basically use, let's say, this isn't exactly how it works, but like a pressure washer. They send this thing down into the ground, they shoot the shale, and they get the gases out of the rock. And then, of course, you've got all those chemicals and all that water that something needs to be done with, as well as all the pollution that's arising coming out of the grounds there. It's a disaster.
And then climate change itself. I mean, fossil fuels are driving climate change. Our use of fossil fuels is what's causing climate change. And that's causing so many water problems across the country. It's warming our waters, like we said earlier, causing more polluted waters. It's causing floods in many places and droughts, wildfires that contaminate water supplies. The whole climate crisis is tied up to our use of fossil fuels. Our water crisis is all tied up into our use of fossil fuels.
And some of the most scary outcomes of climate change are related to water. When we're talking about the melting of the glaciers, that both has an impact on rising sea levels, but it also impacts the available water for agriculture and for drinking water for a good portion of the world's population. So it is a very, very damaging thing when we're talking about potentially billions of people being water refugees because their water supplies that previously existed are no longer available. Oof. It's
lots
something.
Of snowpack too, and no more snow melt to feed the. Yeah, it's a huge impact. And again, like the impacts are so varied. I mean, there's too much water in one place, not enough in another place.
Yeah.
Water is contaminated pretty much across the board too, from wildfires. Hurricanes can hit industrial sites, contaminating water supplies too. So that all of the impacts of climate change are making our access to safe water more and more difficult.
Yeah, indeed. There are solutions. And one of the things that you were talking about was hydrofracking, nuclear power that warms the water, the use of oil. But we have solutions. We have clean energy. Talk about the impact of various forms of clean energy on water and contrast that with, obviously, with the fossil fuels.
Yes, we do have solutions. I think first we need to start with more efficiency, right? Like we need to use less water, less
exactly.
electricity. So making yeah. our homes more efficient and more water efficient, I think it creates good jobs. It's such a god creator in local communities. If we can have it directed towards local communities with good job training programs for people who actually live there, making our homes more energy efficient, more water efficient, that is a really great first place to start. There's also, if we have justly sourced sustainable energy, like justly sourced solar panels on rooftop solar, I know a lot of people are supporting that. There's a lot of solutions out there for how we can transition into more climate resilient and clean, because rooftop solar, of course, is more climate resilient too. In the case of natural disasters, you don't have these gas generators being delivered by FEMA that can pollute and to destroy the air quality and really make people sick. Yeah. So like really transitioning to cleaner, justly sourced and sustainable energy can also make it more climate resilient. So we do need to do that. I think we also really need to start with like stopping fossil fuel extraction. I think calling for a ban on fracking, we need a nationwide ban on fracking. We shouldn't be fracking. It's such a huge water polluter and it is not necessary when we have cleaner, greener solutions.
You put your finger on it there. Mm-hmm. At a point, you could make an argument for all of these dirty forms of energy that kill millions of people around the globe each year and up to hundreds of thousands in the United States alone. But when they're unnecessary, when we've gone past them, when we have cheaper, cleaner, more healthful solutions, you have to ask yourself, why are we continuing to do this? And it is somewhat relatively recent in history that clean energy has become actually cheaper than the dirty forms of energy. Not even thinking about the fact that the dirty energy is so damaging to our health in so many different ways. And that damage comes at a cost. The healthcare costs associated with all of this pollution are enormous, not to mention the cleaning up of the pollution itself. So yes, we have solutions that are now available. The question is, why aren't we using them?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to take a movement. It's going to take everyone getting involved to hold our elected officials accountable. It's about accountability for our elected officials. We really need to build this movement to hold them accountable, because to make these solutions happen, it's not going to happen with the research alone. I mean, there's so much research out there that shows that this is the right solution, that this is what we need to do. There's been, everyone's known about, like researchers have known about the climate crisis for decades.
Of course.
It's a secret. Exxon has been writing about it and planning about it for decades. It's so we need that research to underpin our, what we're, the policy solutions we're advocating. But really, at the end of the day, it's about people getting involved, taking action, holding your elected officials accountable, and becoming part of this movement so that we can have a just transition.
If you don't speak and you don't vote, they don't hear and they don't listen. And it's as simple as that. You need to take action. Each one of us does. And the solutions exist. And also in the area of animal agriculture. Look, we could have said the dairy industry in California, despite the fact that it uses so much water and causes so much pollution, it's necessary. People need milk, even though they don't. The point is, today, we now have plant milks ranging from pea to soy to oat that use a fraction of the water of dairy milk. And they create a fraction of the pollution that all of that, those animals create. And so there again, we have solutions that are readily available, but it does require us to be the consumer that demands those products. And the encouraging thing is that these plant-based milks are taking a sizable portion of the market share from dairy products, because people are understanding that not only are they going to help the environment and be nice to the animals, but they're also going to live a longer life as a result of using a healthful plant-based milk. And this is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're talking to Mary Grants, the Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch. You can find out more about Food and Water Watch at www.foodandwaterwatch.org. That's foodandwaterwatch.org. And we're discussing all about water in the United States. All right, let's move a little bit toward privatization, which is something that you've done a lot of work with and Food and Water Watch has done a lot of work with. I think a good portion of our listeners would be surprised to find that many Americans today do not have access to clean, affordable water. I was surprised until some years ago that this just wasn't available to many people. Water issues such as those that we've witnessed, as you mentioned, in Jackson and Flint, Michigan, they're not as much of an anomaly as we might believe. So, Mary, describe how that's possible that in a civilized and wealthy country, we could have these water crises that are, of course, like all of our environmental challenges, disproportionately impacting certain communities.
No, that's a great question. So across the country, disproportionately, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color are experiencing water crises. They lack access to safe and affordable water. And there's many factors at play. So in Jackson, Mississippi, can use it as a case study. Like we could use Flint as a case study, but it's emblematic of a nationwide problem. Studies have overwhelmingly shown that communities of color are more likely to have toxic water, unhealthy water, water that violates health-based standards. And in particular, these smaller rural communities of color. Indigenous communities are 19 times more likely to violate clean water, drinking water quality regulations. And so for Jackson, Mississippi, let's take it as an example. What is the story in Jackson, Mississippi? It's decades in the making. This water crisis right now in Jackson, decades in the making. It's about systemic racism at play. This is a city, the largest city in Mississippi. It helped build out the state and the surrounding suburbs, this major water system. It helped grow and expand the economy of the state. And then as there was what's known as a phenomenon known as white flight, a lot of the wealthier, whiter residents from Jackson fled to the surrounding suburbs, leaving the city with what's known as stranded assets. So assets that they no longer have the rate base to support. So that's part of the issue. The other issue is that the state is not investing in Jackson, Mississippi. This is a water system that supports so much of the state's economy, but the state is not providing support to Jackson, Mississippi until recently. I think there is some encouraging signs that because of the latest water crisis, that the state may be finally providing some of that support that's necessary. But Jackson, Mississippi has been excluded from grants by the state. The state defines disadvantaged community as small and rural, excluding Jackson from a lot of the federal and state support for disadvantaged communities. So they've been historically excluded from access to federal programs for safe water. And it's really led to deferred maintenance and disinvestment in the system for decades. And it's really, and then on top of this, the climate crisis, like we see around the world, the climate crisis is hitting communities of color hardest and often first and hardest. So it's also a story of the climate crisis because of this historic flooding. Just last year, Jackson, Mississippi's water system was taken offline for weeks because of a cold snap, a historic cold snap. So again, this is the climate crisis colliding with structural inequities, and it's creating a water crisis that is being felt deeply by this majority Black city. And but it's not only Jackson. We're seeing water crises across the country, wells going dry in farm worker communities right next to these big factory farms. So these factory farms can dig wells deep, and they're taking the groundwater and leaving the wells dry for surrounding majority Latino communities. Again, we're seeing the climate crisis with water abuses and structural racism collide, creating water crises that are being felt deeply by many people in this country.
Really, environmental problems, and this is something that was new to me in the last few years. I've been doing this work for decades, but I just wasn't looking at this aspect of it. But environmental problems pretty much would not happen without some kind of racism. And that's not a political statement. It's just a matter of fact. Because in order for the people, the powers that be, to decide I'm going to put that polluting industry there and allow that one to operate over there, they have to know that it's not their family who's going to pay the price. Not only does their family not live there, but if there is a catastrophic impact, they have the resources to go elsewhere. And so there is no environmental injustice without this structural racism. And it's become so clear, and it needs to be repeated over and over again. And the sad reality is that there are many people living in the U.S. who have had their water shut off. Mm-hmm. And whoever thinks of that, your water is going to be shut off. We're not going to shut off your air supply because we can't. We'll pollute it, but we can't shut it off. So talk about that, the water shutoffs, and explain Food and Water Watch's work in this area.
Sure. So I think as context for Jackson and context for water shutoffs, we need to think about our water systems. A lot of our water systems were built after World War II, right? There was this huge infusion of funding, especially for wastewater systems in the 1970s, again, where rivers were on fire. We needed to clean up our rivers. We passed the Clean Water Act. It's going to be the 50-year anniversary in October of the Clean Water Act. And part of that package, why Nixon vetoed the Clean Water Act originally, was because of the funding for wastewater systems. That was really what motivated him to veto it. Congress overrode the veto, fortunately, and passed it into law. But the Clean Water Act was historic legislation to try to clean up our rivers that were on fire. Part of that was funding so that many communities across the country could build wastewater treatment plants. So again, decades ago, 50 years ago, 50 years more, 100 years ago, these were when our water systems, wastewater systems were built. And these systems are now old. Since the 1970s, federal funding has fallen by 82% for water infrastructure. Federal funding peaked for water infrastructure in 1977. It peaked in the 1970s. It's kind of mind-boggling. Even with the bipartisan infrastructure law, it does not catch up to what we spent in 1977. So amazing. Federal funding has fallen so much. And at the same time, our systems are now old. They need to be improved. They need to be climate resilient. Our climate is changing. We need to build climate resilient systems to plan for the weather that we're experiencing today. We also are learning more about these chemicals that we've allowed industry, or our government has allowed industry, to pollute into our waterways like PFAS. So we need to build stronger, better treatment systems to remove these chemicals, remove lead, remove PFAS from our water. So this is expensive. Federal funding is gone. What's happening? Water rates for local people, their water bills going up dramatically. The burden of this, all of this, is falling on the backs of working people. And water rates are incredibly regressive. They're one of the most regressive bills you pay. For a family, they're going to pay disproportionate amount on their water bill than a corporation will. So this is causing a water affordability crisis in the country. This predates the pandemic. It's been a crisis for a while, and it's really, it started to hit home for a lot of people during the pandemic. But we did a survey in 2018 before the pandemic, and we found that in a typical year, that water system shut off 15 million people because they couldn't afford their bill. So 15 million people were losing water service simply because they could not afford these ever-increasing water rates. That was shocking to me. I didn't realize it would be so high, honestly. I mean, it's one of those things you defend, you turn on the water, it flows. It's so important for public health. Without water, you can't wash your hands. You can't flush your toilet. You can't cook your food. It's so hard to clean your house. You can't wash clothing. It's the impact of it is very profound. One of the things we learned from activists in Detroit who have been sounding the alarm for this for the last two decades is that in some cases, it can also tear families apart. Children are being taken from their guardians when water is shut off. It's heartbreaking. Just because you can't afford your water bill, you could lose your children. And we do need to have safe homes for children, but we need to make sure that people have bills that they can afford to pay. That we need to make sure that water is available for everyone, that we're not tearing people apart, tearing families apart, just because water rates are going up. So this is a crisis when the pandemic hit. We were one of the first organizations to call for a nationwide shutoff moratorium. We joined a broad utility justice coalition, thousands of organizations calling for a nationwide moratorium on all utility shutoffs during the pandemic. You might remember at the very beginning of the pandemic, CDC's advice was not wearing masks, it was washing your hands. And so without water, you can't wash your hands. It's a public health threat. There's actually a lot of research from We the People of Detroit about the water shutoffs in Detroit. Tens of thousands of people have been shut off from water in Detroit. Their research has shown that there was an increase in waterborne illnesses in zip codes with more water shutoffs. So it is impacting public health. It's intuitive, it's common sense, but they have research that backs that up. So water shutoffs have a profound impact, and water affordability is a growing crisis nationwide.
It is indeed. And again, to have water shutoffs, you can't be looking at water as a basic human right. Mm-hmm. The two do not go together. A Food and Water Watch article that I read on privatization of our water system stated, we must manage our water as a common resource, not a profit center, and we must provide tap water as a public service, not a business. And the article went on to explain, as you mentioned, the diminishing federal funding for water services over the years. So explain what the privatization of our water supply is and discuss the problems you see surrounding privatization and the reduction in federal funding.
Yeah. So when water systems aren't being funded, communities don't have the resources. Corporations see that as a place to make money. They come in, they try to buy up these systems. But what happens is that rates go up dramatically. If a community is already facing a water affordability crisis, they simply cannot afford the cost of privatization. On average, private companies charge 59% more than local governments for the same amount of water. And if you're really struggling to make ends meet, that can make a very big difference. So water privatization, it sacrifices local control over a resource that is so essential for life. So right now, we're actually seeing a feeding frenzy driven by laws that these corporations have helped pass in states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Missouri and Illinois. There's a feeding frenzy on local community water systems. The companies are targeting them, offering local governments these large sums of money. In Bucks County, Pennsylvania, a company is offering $1.1 billion for the wastewater system. $1.1 billion just for the wastewater system. And why would they do that? Why would they offer this large sum of money? Because they can add it to the rates, right? So state regulators allow them to add it to the rates. plus profit. Companies are allowed to earn around a 10% rate of return on their investment. So that's money that's built into the rate structure, and it can lead to sizable, substantial, and really hard-hitting rate increases on residents. One resident recently just got their water system, their sewer system was sold a couple of years ago, and they finally got their bill, and it went up 89% just with the latest rate increase. So these are really dramatic increases in rates that they're seeing, but communities are fighting back against it. In Pennsylvania, there's an amazing local group called Neighbors Opposing Privatization Efforts. They're going around educating communities, local officials, about what's really at stake with privatization and what is the cost of privatization.
Great, great. Because privatization, obviously, right off the bat, they're taking a water system that operates at a certain cost and they're adding a profit on top of that. Who's going to pay that profit? In addition, it has an impact on jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on average, one third of jobs are lost after privatization. This is typically through attrition. They just don't hire people as they leave. But what does that mean for a customer? If you're a consumer of that water system, slower response times. You have to call a call center, someone outside of your town. You're calling this like 1-800 number or somewhere else, and you're getting the run through. We've talked to so many residents of private systems where they just couldn't get a billing dispute resolved. Like they were given the run through, hit one, hit two, and then nothing happens. So it really does sacrifice a lot of that local control, as well as a lot of that accountability over service outcomes.
This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're talking to Mary Grant, the Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch. And you can find out more about the great work of Food and Water Watch at www.foodandwaterwatch.org. That's foodandwaterwatch.org. Mary, explain what the Water Affordability, Transparency, Equity, and Reliability Act is and how it addresses everything that you've discussed.
Sure. So there are solutions out there. Like we talked about before, there are solutions out there. This isn't an unwinnable situation. We just need to build the political will to pass these laws. And one of them is the Water Act, the Water Affordability, Transparency, Equity, and Reliability Act. It's in the House and the Senate right now, more than 100 co-sponsors in Congress right now. This is a comprehensive bill to fully fund our water infrastructure, creating a water trust fund to help water systems, wastewater systems, household wells, septic systems, providing communities and residents with the resources they need to have safe and affordable water.
Great. And Food and Water Watch, of course, is involved in all of these efforts.
Yes, and you can visit our website to take action to tell your Congress member to co-sponsor the Water Act. That's foodandwaterwatch.org. And we welcome you to get more involved. Sign up to volunteer with us and urge our Congress members, our elected officials to take action, co-sponsor these really groundbreaking pieces of legislation, and help us fight some of these bad, false solutions that are out there.
Yes, please do that. We can get into a place where we're waiting for the governments to take action. Like, okay, we've got a water crisis. What's the governor going to do? What's the president going to do? What's Congress going to do? And we need them to act. However, we also see solutions coming from aspects of the various parts of the communities and localities that are dealing with water issues. And you've mentioned some of these. Is there anything else you'd like to add about how communities are responding to some of the threats of privatization on affordable water and related issues?
Sure. There's a bunch of amazing coalitions out there, local organizations doing real work on the ground. In Detroit, there's the People's Water Board Coalition, who have been organizing for two decades now, fighting for affordable water. They're also doing that direct aid, that immediate assistance to residents who are struggling. There's also organizations in Pennsylvania really aggressively fighting off privatization, Neighbors Opposing Privatization Efforts. And then in like communities like Chicago and Baltimore, there are these coalitions fighting for really bold pieces of legislation. Baltimore, they banned water privatization, and then they passed an income-based water affordability program. And it was really driven by the Baltimore Right to Water Coalition. We're part of it, along with a bunch of other organizations. It was modeled off of what Philadelphia did. So there's really these local solutions that can help address our affordability crisis right now. It's by stopping privatization and then passing these income-based water affordability programs that really meet people where they're at so that cities can provide affordable water now as we fight for that federal funding that can make sure that our water systems are equitable for everyone.
Any other actions you'd recommend for individuals to take?
I definitely recommend for folks to visit our website, take action with us, sign up to volunteer, and get more involved in your community. I think that for my vision of change, how I view it is that we all need to vote. Absolutely, everyone should vote, but then we also need to realize that our role in government goes beyond voting. We need to take action. We need to get involved in our local communities, attend meetings, sign petitions, make phone calls, really show up and turn out so that we can create the change that we need to have happen. Because what's at stake is so big. This is our water. This is our food. This is our planet. So we really do need everyone to get involved, to show up and turn out.
Indeed. Mary, there was a Mary Grant before she was involved with all of this work. And there is the Mary Grant of today. Talk about your journey, how it started, how you were motivated to get involved in this, and what turns it took to bring you here.
I think I've always been an environmentalist. I remember digging through trash in college to sort, or in high school to sort out the recyclables. I think that's where a lot of environmentalists start in grade school and high school. With the recycling campaigns. And then in college, I did work for an environmental justice organization in North Carolina called Clean Water for North Carolina. And I got to go around and door knock on some communities. And that's really what motivated me to work with Food and Water Watch and fight water privatization in particular. There was this one community, the Neuse River community, outside Raleigh. Their waters, they had always, this is a recent immigrant community, majority Spanish speaking community. They had always paid their water bills as part of their rent. Then another big, large company came in, bought the water system, started charging them separately, but didn't give them notices in Spanish. More than half the community had the water shut off. Families were going down to a river to collect water. A baby got poisoned from E. coli, had to go to the hospital. I mean, that's what's motivating me. And that's why I feel so strongly about privatization. I keep going back to that story and having that experience, actually door knocking in that community and talking with people there about what the impact of that privatization was.
Great. Well, I thank you for all of the work that you're doing. And I thank Food and Water Watch again for the amazing work on many different issues that they're always taking on. And thank you for joining us on the Healthy Planet Radio Show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We've been talking to Mary Grant, the Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch. They're at www.foodandwaterwatch.org. Well, we certainly are living in interesting times. I know that we at Healthy Planet, the nonprofit organization that I've been involved with for decades, and on this radio show, of course, have been pushing the words of the best scientists on our planet also for decades. Talking to you, educating you, inspiring you about the need to take on climate change right now as something that's coming. You know, here we are in 2022, and the impacts are here to be seen. So much of what is happening has been predicted. It's happening even faster than we thought it would. We're seeing all the flooding, most recently in Jackson, Mississippi. We're seeing massive floods in Pakistan that they've never seen anything like before, one third of the country being underwater. We're seeing the Colorado River drying up, the massive reservoirs of Lake Mead and Lake Powell drying up. We're seeing unprecedented droughts across the globe. We're seeing water shortages. We're seeing fires everywhere from California to Siberia to Australia. And of course, the heat waves. And I could go on and on. But you know it as well as I do because you're living through this just like I am. But suffice it to say, the reality is that climate change is now visible outside of our windows and on the daily news. And while nobody has wanted this to happen, and nobody wants it to get worse, as it's predicted that it will. They say that the warmest year of today is going to be the coolest in future years. So imagine that, considering what we're experiencing with parts of the globe getting too hot for people to live. While all that is true, there's some good news in what's happening right now. And that is, as I said a moment ago, it is showing up on the nightly news. And those people who have been denying the reality of climate change, well, they've got to start somehow shuffling and squirming and figuring out how to get on the right side of this issue that's getting harder and harder to deny. And that's of utmost importance because while people listening to this show might say, yeah, climate change, of course we know about it, of course we've been seeing what's happening, and of course air pollution in itself is just so deadly, we may as well tackle climate change at the same time. Even though you might be saying that, there has been a large portion of the population that is being misled by a particular political party that is pretty much across the board still voting against all major measures to address climate change in a serious way. Now, we live in the most powerful country on this planet. So what our government does on an issue as important as climate change resounds across the world. So when half of our government is stuck denying climate change and keeping us from taking meaningful action on climate change, it impacts the whole world. Again, I think that can't continue because it's becoming apparent that with climate change now manifesting in so many different ways in the daily news, and one of our political parties still refusing to take action, it's becoming apparent that it either indicates that they are misleading the public or that they are misled themselves. And if they're misled themselves about an issue that's so clear in the scientific community, then they are not fit to be leaders. So my plea is to those of you out there who are Republicans, talk to your party, talk to other Republicans you know, let them know that this issue of climate change has nothing to do with not believing in your conservative values. Let them know that it's a humanitarian, justice, economic, geopolitical, and economic issue that's going to hit everybody, regardless of our political affiliations. And since I'm talking so much about the nightly news and what's showing up there about climate change for the first time that we've really been seeing ever, here's a clip from the NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt about the Colorado River and what's going on with the water situation there.
The boundless beauty of the Colorado River stretches far beyond what first appears surface deep. It's a 1,400-mile life-sustaining artery, pumping fresh water into the heart of the American West's ecology. And for us humans, it serves as a critical hydropower highway, streaming power generated at Lake Powell all the way to Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir, where excess water is banked in a system that supplies 40 million people in seven states out west. But that power is shrinking.
The Colorado River is about 20% smaller than it was just 20 years ago.
Sinjin Eberle studies the Colorado for the conservation organization American Rivers.
Three of the top 10 largest cities in the nation all get their water from the Colorado River. So that's an amazing amount of impact on a system that's literally getting smaller.
Smaller and weaker. Heavy demand from the Southwest's exploding population, combined with rapid climate change in the heat of a decades-long mega drought, have plummeted water levels at the two lakes that feed the river.
And just to give you a sense of the scope of this crisis, you go back before the drought and where I'm standing right now, I'd be about 40 feet underwater.
Right now, both Lake Powell and Lake Mead are nearly three-fourths empty and projected to continue dropping.
So where exactly are we, Bob?
So right now we're on top of the dam. Top of Glen Canyon Dam. If we look off to our left is Lake Powell, and off to our right is the Colorado River.
We were given exclusive access to the Glen Canyon Dam, where water from the lake is released through eight massive turbines.
This is the goose that lays the golden egg for the Southwest.
Generating enough power to electrify millions of homes, businesses, farms, and more than 50 Native American tribes.
How much power are we generating right now?
Right now we're probably around 400 megawatts. The ability to produce power is going down as the reservoir is going down.
Power manager Bob Martin says the water level at the dam is just 45 feet from dropping below hydropower generation. So critical that for the first time in the dam's history, it's reducing the amount of water released into the Colorado River.
Does it feel like you're in a threat zone?
It does. We're 22 years into this drought. Nobody ever expected we'd be here this long. We need to start making operational changes.
The crisis has led to historic water rationing measures.
We really need to reduce the amount of water we're taking out of the Colorado River by, you know, something like 20%. For the long term.
Earlier this year, the federal government set a deadline for the seven basin states that surround the river to come up with a voluntary plan to reduce water use.
What keeps me up at night is that that the states will decide to fight rather than come together and be a unified voice for the entire basin.
This month, that nightmare came to life. Instead of working together to solve the problem, the states bickered over dwindling resources, forcing the Bureau of Reclamation to declare a Tier 2 emergency shortage, mandating historic water rationing. Starting in January, Arizona will lose 21% of its yearly allocation from the river. Nevada loses 8%, Mexico 7%.
What is at stake if we don't do that is 40 million people's water availability, a $1.4 trillion economy that is based on the Colorado River. All of that is at risk, and that's an enormous risk to the country, to the world.
The crisis creating a domino effect. Right now, the consequences of drought and water shortages are now playing out across the country. 34% of the Midwest is abnormally dry or experiencing drought. 70% of the West is in a moderate drought. And 98% of California is in severe drought. The exceptional heat is also creating mounting pressure on energy grids, meaning filling the falling hydropower void with natural gas, creating more greenhouse gas emissions and an even hotter planet. The lack of water creating an uncertain future for farmers.
We're not making money. You know, as a matter of fact, we're losing it, and we don't know how long we can hang in there.
Third-generation Arizona farmer Nancy Kaywood says less than half of her 247-acre farm is producing crops.
My son has got worry lines and bags under his eyes, so do I, because we constantly worry about how we're going to hang in there.
Looking for any hint of a solution, we spoke to the Federal Bureau of Reclamation at the head of power and water in the West.
That's not an easy problem to solve.
Regional Bureau Director Katrina Grant says the way forward is still firmly centered on collaboration between the Western states.
We really are committed to working closely with the basin states on what they come up with and how we can implement that together. And I firmly believe that a collaborative solution is the best approach. So we are committed to continuing to work together.
But with the crisis deepening by the day and no solid plan on the horizon, the outlook is tough for a region already drying up. A fragile flow on the brink of total collapse. Steve Patterson, NBC News, the Grand Canyon.
And before we sign off, I'll mention that our guest on next week's show, Friday, September 9th at 6 p.m., is a plant-based doctor practicing in New Jersey and New York, Dr. Ron Weiss. Dr. Weiss prescribes the Ethos Diet, an all-organic, ecologically sustainable, and whole foods plant-based diet as the cornerstone of his work with patients. But there's something else that makes him unique, and that is that he's not only a physician, but also a botanist and farmer, and he offers an evidence-based food as medicine approach to healing from chronic illnesses and optimizing wellness. And that's again on Friday, September 9th at 6 p.m. on WUSB 90.1 FM. And on that note, the following is a public service announcement for an event that Dr. Weiss's Ethos Farm is holding this month, September 24th and 25th. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ron Weiss. I'm a medical doctor, farmer, and the founder of a nonprofit Ethos Farm project. Ethos's mission is to address the interconnected nature of how agriculture impacts human and planetary health and our relationship with animals. We grow regenerative organic food to feed our community, restore the land, and raise a new generation of farmers, doctors, and nurses. Please join me on September 24th and 25th at our beautiful 342-acre National Historic Landmark Farm in Long Valley, New Jersey. You'll be inspired by world-renowned speakers, amazing activities, and delicious plant-based food right here on the farm. Go to www.ethosfarmproject.org or call 631-599-6138. Thank you. See you all down on the farm.
And that's all we have time for this evening. This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show. I'll be with you again at the same time next Friday, September 9th at 6 p.m., and every month thereafter at 6 p.m. on the first two Fridays of the month. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to the Natural Alternatives lineup, with great hosts sharing cutting-edge information on health, our environment, and much more. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. For more information on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. That's healthyplanetusa.org. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right and by continuing to speak about climate change to those people you know. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four or multi-legged friends. And finally, remember to enjoy each and every moment of your precious existence on this beautiful planet. Good night.